So Lex had mentioned earlier that I have interrupted myself. So last week I brought a message. I had notes on Romans chapter 4 and chapter 5, and we ran out of time, and so it turned out it was just a message on Romans 4. So one would think this week would be Romans chapter 5. But I was so fascinated by the story of Esther, and I wanted to talk about that this morning. And so I checked with me if it would be okay if I interrupted myself, and I agreed that it would be okay. But I told myself, don't let it happen again. So having concluded those harsh words with myself, I want to talk about the book of Esther. And I don't know if you're like me, but I'd kind of forgotten about it. I actually, when I was searching for trivia questions for the game of Jeopardy at Hoshua, I was like, oh yeah, I could pull something out of there. But you know, my routine is every morning I listen through scripture, and one of the portions that they read right at the moment is the story of Esther. And it's really a fascinating story. There are 10 chapters, so we've got a lot of ground to cover. I'm not going to read the whole thing. But it really, to me, it's such a fascinating story. And I don't know when the last time is that you read through Esther. Anybody currently in Esther in your readings? You are? Oh, awesome. Why don't you come up here and help me out? We would love to hear from Joseph. To me, it would make an epic motion picture. I don't know why there's not more movies out there on that. I know VeggieTales did a take on it back in 2000. I thought about watching that just in sermon prep, you know. But it's fascinating. So just a little bit of the context. The story takes place in Susa, at the Citadel in Susa. And it is, that's about 900 miles east of Jerusalem. It's in Persia. And the story takes place after the Babylonian captivity. So you remember, I could go through the Bible timeline, but we're out of time, so we're going to skip that. You know where it is. It's in history. And about 450 BC, ballpark. And so it starts with King Ahasuerus throwing a party. But it's not just a party. It was 180 days, not just a little soiree. It was 6 months of partying followed by a 7-day feast, a banquet. Reading from Esther chapter 1, verses 1 through 9, it took place in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. I'll skip to verse 3. In the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his princes and attendants, the army officers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of his provinces being in his presence. Verse 4, and he displayed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor of his great majesty for many days, 180 days. When those days were completed, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days for all the people who were present at the citadel in Susa, from the greatest to the least, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. Verse 6, there were hangings of fine white and violet linen held by cords of fine purple linen on silver rings, and marble columns and couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. Drinks were served in golden vessels of various kinds, and the royal wine was plentiful according to the king's bounty. Now, verse 8, the drinking was done in according to the law. There was no compulsion, for so the king had given orders to each official of his household that he should do according to the desires of each person. Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the palace which belonged to King Ahasuerus. The king. We'll just call him the king. And so, again, as I'm reading this story, I'm just picturing this as an epic motion picture. I can see the opening scene with all of the pomp and circumstance. It said earlier, hangings of fine white and violet linen, silver rings, marble columns, couches of gold and silver. And you can see the camera panning around to this wonderful scene as the party opens. But after 7 days of, after 180 days of displaying all his greatness and 7 days of feasting and drinking, revelry, he summons Queen Vashti to come, and he wanted to show her great beauty. And she refused. "I'm not coming." So they decided they can't let that stand, because what would happen if word gets out that the queen told the king no and he did nothing about it? I mean, just think. Women everywhere would start to tell their husbands no. "We can't have that. We are going to fix this." I would say they failed. They did not fix it. But their remedy was that they would have Vashti banished, and they would go get a new harem for the king. Women that were more beautiful. So teaching point right here. Revelry leads to problems in your marriage. Let's just mark that one down, okay? Husbands are supposed to love, respect, and protect their wives, not demand that they be put on display to show their beauty. And we can add even one more teaching point here. Teaching point: one bad decision typically leads to another. So instead of apologizing for his foolishness to his wife, he followed the other men's advice and said, "Well, let's just go get a harem." So one bad decision leads to another. So again, in our epic motion picture, we're all directors this morning. I want you to see this. So we're going to switch to the subplot, and there is a Jew at the Citadel in Susa, which, by the way, that's the title of the message, "At the Citadel in Susa." So this Jew, his name is Mordecai. You'll remember that. And especially Joseph, you'll remember that. Mordecai, having just read it. Now, he was raising his cousin. Her name was Hadassah. You also know her as Esther. Her parents had died. And the word actually tells us that she was lovely of form and face. Mordecai had taken her under his wing, and he's raising her as his own daughter. And then the king has his problem, and he goes and collects all the pretty women of the land, 127 provinces to pick from, and Esther is in the mix. So again, jumping over a lot of this history, but there's effectively a beauty pageant, who's the fairest in the land, and it turns out it's Esther. And so not only was Esther the most beautiful, but when she was presented to the king, he was like, "You're going to be the queen." So Esther 2:17, "The king loved Esther more than all the women, and she found favor and kindness with him more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti." So another good teaching point right here. The good will rise to the top. Okay, so the Jews were oppressed, and they had been taken captive to Babylon. These aren't the upper crust people, but now here she is queen, right? So again, here's another little subplot in the script where we read in Esther chapter 2, where Mordecai foils an assassination attempt. So reading from verse 21 of chapter 2, "In those days, while Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's officials from those who guarded the door, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. But the plot became known to Mordecai, and he told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. Now when the plot was investigated and found to be so, they were both hanged on a gallows, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the king's presence." So once again, right here in this wonderful little story with all these subplots and everything, here's another teaching point, and that is that diligence in doing what's right, even in a difficult situation. Again, Jews are oppressed people living in Babylon, and you would think Mordecai could care less who's the king, and finding out that the king is about to be assassinated, he still did the right thing. Just like if I were to find out that there was an assassination attempt being plotted for Joe Biden, I would do the right thing, and I would report it. Only because I don't like Kamala Harris. All right, a little humor. But anyway, diligence. Do the right thing no matter what, right? And so this is what Mordecai is doing. Well, then, again, another scene change, just so quick. We read the rise of another character in our major epic motion picture here. Haman is promoted by King Ahasuerus, and he's over all the princes. He's basically the number two guy. I don't know what his title was, Secretary of State or Satrap, or they got all kinds of titles. But anyway, he was Mr. Big. We could call him that. He's Mr. Big. So the king commanded that for Haman, anytime he walks in the room, you didn't just stand up, you didn't salute. What he required was that everyone bow down when Haman comes in. And it wasn't worship. It's not like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were required to bow down before the golden statue and, you know, give worship. This is just basically the form of respect that he required. And so the king commanded people bow in the presence of Haman. Mordecai, nah, he couldn't tolerate that. He refused to bow in the presence of Haman. Not going to do it. Just not going to do it. And so when Haman found out, when he saw that he walks in and there's one man standing there who, and everyone else is bowing down, and he finds out that this Mordecai guy, he's like, I'm taking him out. But then he realizes that he's a Jew, and there's a whole lot of Jews. There's actually millions in Persia at that time. And so he didn't do anything to to Mordecai, but he did decide that we're just going to kill all the Jews. I can't kill Haman. I'm sorry. I can't kill Mordecai, so we'll kill them all. And you can see that, again, the script writer is doing a great, great job of painting Haman as a complete narcissist. I mean, it's one thing to be proud. And, you know, this guy isn't giving me the respect I deserve. But if you're a narcissist, you can't tolerate it when someone doesn't give you the respect that you deserve. And you've got to do something. You've got to take them out. And so that's this is where Haman is coming from, and he works out the deal with the king. And so we read this in Esther chapter 3, verses 7 through 11. It says, in the first month, which is the month Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, Pur, that is the lot, was cast before Haman from day to day and from month to month until the 12th month, that is Adar. Let me just pause and say, Haman has got this plan. We're going to annihilate all the Jews. But I got to figure out the right time to present this to the king. And so every day, every single day, day to day, month to month, he's casting lots and trying to find out, is this the day? Is this the right time for me to present this to the king so we can kill all the Jews? Little Hitler. Verse 8, then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the peoples in the province of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of all other people, and they do not observe the king's laws, so it is not in the king's interest to let them remain. If it's pleasing to the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed. I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who carry out the king's business to put into the king's treasuries. 10,000 talents of silver. I don't know the current conversion rate. I heard one commentary years ago said it was like $18 million. So he's wealthy, and he's willing to pay millions of dollars to make sure they're all dead. Verse 10, then the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. The king said to Haman, the silver is yours and the people also, to do with them as you please. All right, so Haman works out all the particulars of exactly how we're going to annihilate all the Jews. Reading from Esther chapter 3, verses 13 and 14, letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, women and children, in one day. And that day is the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to seize their possessions as plunder. Verse 14, a copy of the edict was to be issued as law in every province, was published to all the people so that they should be ready for this day. So, just another quick teaching point. Pride and arrogance on the part of Mordecai. I am not going to bow to Mordecai. I mean, Haman. I can't get the names right. He's probably got a hat on that says, make Israel great again, or not my satrap, or something like that. But he's just refusing out of nationalism, out of patriotism, which I like a lot, but he refused to bow. I am just not going to give the man the respect that is due. And in all seriousness, if I were in a place where President Biden walks in the room, I will be respectful. I will stand, I'll be very puzzled why I'm there. But anyway, there's respect that's due him, but he refused to give that respect. He was too proud. He was too arrogant. And because of that, the whole nation is going to be annihilated. There are penalties for our actions. So it's a teaching moment. Pride and arrogance lead to destruction. So when they find out that every Jew is going to be destroyed on that certain day, needless to say, Mordecai was a little distraught. And even Queen Esther, when she found out, said that then Esther's maidens and her eunuchs came out and told her, and the queen writhed in great anguish. From chapter 4, starting at verse 9, Hathrak came back and related Mordecai's words to Esther. Then Esther spoke to Hathach, and ordered him to reply to Mordecai, quote, all the king's servants and all the people of the king's provinces know that for any man or woman who comes to the king to the inner court who is not summoned, he has but one law, that he be put to death, unless the king holds out to him the golden scepter so that he may live. And I've not been summoned to come to the king for these 30 days. Then Esther related these words to, they related Esther's words to Mordecai. Now, let me pause and say, as Esther and Mordecai are communicating back and forth a little bit through courier service, they say something has to be done. And so Esther says, well, I'll go before the king. The problem is, if he doesn't ask me to come, it could be a death sentence. If he's unhappy that day, if he's too busy, he could just be off with her head. Then Mordecai's reply here, Esther 4, verses 13 and 14, do not imagine that you're in the king's palace, that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish, and who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this. So, what happens next? We read in verses 15 to 17 of chapter 4. Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, go assemble all the Jews who are found in Susa, and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maidens will also fast in the same way. And thus I will go in to the king, which is not according to the law. And if I perish, I perish. So Mordecai went away and did just as Esther had commanded him. So here's another teaching moment. We could say when the peanut butter hits the fan, get things in order, get focused, and take the next step, even if it means potentially losing everything. Go for the gusto, as they say. But again, the plot thickens. You can see in our script here that we've got this favored queen, beauty queen no less, favored queen, rich, powerful king, and there's this great risk because life and death is hanging in the balance. All of the Jews are subject to be annihilated. It's now a decree sealed with the king's signet ring. And now she's going to go before the king and risk and hope that he's feeling happy that day and that she can live. So again, moving quickly through the story, she goes before the king, finds favor in his sight, and he extends the golden scepter. She touches the golden scepter and he says, so what do you want? Up to half my kingdom. What do you want? And she says, well, what I would like is for you and Haman to come for dinner tonight. I'll put on a banquet for the two of you. And so they're quite happy to go. Haman, of course, the narcissist, the king and the queen have invited me by name to dinner. And so he's feeling quite happy about this. And so they go to dinner. And while they're at dinner, the king's like, okay, we're here. What do you want? And she says, well, you know, can you come back tomorrow? So I don't know, did she chicken out or what? But she was like, no, tomorrow. Come back for one more meal. So so they leave that banquet. And as they're going their way, Haman passes by Mordecai once again. And Mordecai stands there like, ain't bowing. And it so gets at Haman, he just can't stand it. And so we read this in Esther chapter 5, just a few verses starting at verse 9. Then Haman went out that day glad and pleased of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate and that he did not stand up or tremble, Haman was filled with anger against Mordecai. Haman controlled himself, however, went to his house and sent for his friends and his wife Zeresh. Then Haman recounted to them the glory of his riches and the number of sons and every instance where the king had magnified him and how he had promoted him above the princes and servants of the king. Haman also said, even Esther the queen, let no one but me come with the king to the banquet which she had prepared, and tomorrow I'm also invited by her with the king. Yet, all of this does not satisfy me. Every time I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. Then Zeresh his wife and all his friends said to him, well, just have a gallows 50 cubits high made, and in the morning ask the king to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go joyfully with the king to the banquet. And the advice pleased Haman. So he had the gallows made. 75 feet high. I want to make sure anybody in town could see someone swinging from the gallows. But just a funny thing happened that night. The king couldn't sleep. So day one, come to the banquet. What do you want? I want you to come back tomorrow. That night before the tomorrow banquet, that night the king couldn't sleep. Well, two things happened that night. Haman's walking home, sees Mordecai, and he just can't stand it. I mean, he's got 10 sons, he's got all these riches, he's got all the glory from the king, he's been invited by dinner, all these wonderful things, but I cannot stand the fact that this man won't bow. So, well, make gallows. Okay, hey, gallows company, I need a 75-footer tomorrow morning. And they're rolling. And at the same time, King Ahasuerus just can't sleep that night. Now, I don't know if maybe Esther put something in the meal, but again, this epic motion picture, they call this rising action, where we're headed towards a climactic moment in this movie. And so while the king just can't sleep, he's like, what should I do? I could listen to one of Paul Greenlee's messages. That would do it. What he did is he had someone read him a bedtime story. Technically, it was the chronicles of his reign. And so they're going through one by one through the stories. And they come across the story where Mordecai had foiled an assassination attempt. And again, we're just breezing through these 10 chapters here. We got the movie on fast forward. But and then he says, well, so what did we do for Mordecai? Go ahead, keep going. Well, nothing was done. We didn't do anything for him. Well, then, wouldn't you know it, the scene cuts and we see Haman coming in the courtyard. And so the king says to Haman, what should I do for someone that I want to honor? And again, this is more of the rising action. Now, Haman knows that when the king asked, what should I do for the man that I want to honor? The narcissist goes, that's me. Well, king, what you need to do is you need to take one of the robes that you wear and put it on that man. Take one of the horses that you ride, put the man and the robe on that horse. And then have one of your most highest men parade that guy through town and tell everyone, this is what will be done for the man whom the king wants to honor. That's what you should do. And as his chest is probably just about to bust with pride. let me read the text, Esther 6, verse 7. Then Haman said to the king, "For the man whom the king desires to honor, let them bring a royal robe which the king has worn, and the horse on which the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown has been placed, and let the robe and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble princes, and let them array the man whom the king desires to honor, and lead him on horseback through the city square, and proclaim before him, 'Thus it shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor.'" And in this awesome motion picture, the next thing that comes out of the king's mouth is, "Then the king said to Haman," verse 10, "Take quickly the robes and the horse, as you've said, and do so for Mordecai the Jew, who is sitting at the king's gate. Do not fall short in anything of all that you have said." Can you imagine the explosions that must have taken place on the inside of Haman? He's like, "It's me. I can almost see me on that horse right now. Get the Instagram pictures ready. We're going to do some selfies. And then, yeah, do it for Mordecai." And then he says, "And don't fall short." I mean, make sure he gets the right robe. And you're going to be the one to lead and to say. So another teaching moment here. Pride goes before a fall. So Mr. Narcissist was so swelled up that, I'm going to dinner with the king and queen. I've been invited by name. Blah, 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 blah. You're the one who's going to take Mordecai. Pride goes before a fall. So Esther chapter 6, verse 12, Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman hurried home, mourning, with his head covered. I think that's Hebrew for with his tail between his legs. Haman recounted to Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends, everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and Zeresh, his wife, said to him, "If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish origin, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him." Now again, our epic motion picture, verse 14, "While they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hastily brought Haman to the banquet which Esther had prepared." Again, we're into some major plot twist, and I'm telling you, the script, right? I don't understand why Hollywood hasn't done this thing. This is so perfect. It's like just put it to print and on screen. So at the second banquet, the king asks again, "What do you want? I'll give you up to half my kingdom." And this is where Queen Esther says, "I want my life and the lives of my people." She said, we've been sold. Now, if we'd been sold into slavery, I wouldn't have bothered you. Really? I mean, think about that. But anyway, I wouldn't have bothered you. But we've been sold to death. And so I'm asking for my life. And the king is absolutely incensed. He cannot believe that someone wants to kill Queen Esther and whoever her people are. And so he wants to know who did this. Esther 7, verse 6, her reply, "A foe and an enemy is this wicked Haman." Then Haman became terrified before the king and queen. Again, I could just imagine what's going off inside his heart and mind. The queen has just now said he's the guy, and the king is very angry. And so you might think that this is a climactic scene, but oh, not yet. The king is so enraged that he steps out of the room into the garden to kind of collect his thoughts. While he's out there collecting his thoughts, Haman has decided, "I got to get her to shut up. I need her to change her mind. I'm going to die here." And so he decides, "I will beg her." And as he goes toward her, the couch where she's sitting, and as he falls toward her to beg for his life, that's the precise moment that the king walks back in from the garden. And he sees Haman, it looks to him like falling on his wife. So Esther 7 verse 8 says, "Now when the king returned from the palace garden into the place where they were drinking wine, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. Then the king said, will he even assault the queen with me in the house? And then I love the wording of this. This is a beautiful script. As the word went out of the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. In other words, Secret Service was all over this man in a minute. As soon as he moved toward the queen after this situation, they were all over him. And they bagged him, tagged him, and dragged him out. And as you know from the story, the next morning, he was hanged on the gallows that he had built for Mordecai. My, how the tables have turned. Haman is exposed. He's hanged on the gallows that he built for Mordecai. But there's still a problem, because it's a really good movie. There's still a problem because the king's decree was irrevocable. You can't just say, well, Haman's dead, so don't kill the Jews. No, that stands, because if it's a decree from the king and it's sealed with his signet ring, it's irrevocable or irreversible. So Esther 8, verses 8 through 14, well, let me back up a step. So as they work through this whole thing, the queen says, you know, we still got a problem here. And she says, make that thing stop. And he explains that, no, you can't make that thing stop. So verse 8 of chapter 8, now you write to the Jews as you see fit in the king's name and seal it with the king's signet ring. For a decree which is written in the name of the king and sealed with the king's signet ring may not be revoked. So the king's scribes were called at that time in the third month, which is the month Sivan, on the 23rd day. And it was written according to all that Mordecai commanded to the Jews, the satraps, the governors, and the princes, and the provinces extended from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces, to each province according to its script and to each people according to their language. Let's get to verse 10. I'm sorry. He wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed it with the king's signet ring. And he sent it out. And verse 11, in them the king granted the Jews who were in each and every city the right to assemble and to defend their lives, to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate the entire army of any people or province which might attack them, including children and women, and to plunder their spoil. On one day, in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, the 13th day of the 12th month, does that ring a bell? That was the exact day that Haman had set up for all the Jews to be killed. Well, it's on that day, the new decree said that all the Jews can band together and wipe out their enemy. Let's see. Verse 13, a copy of the edict to be issued as law in each and every province was published to all the peoples, so that the Jews would be ready for this day to avenge themselves on their enemies. All right, so again, moving quickly through the movie here. On that day, when the time came, not one Jew died. 75,000 of their haters died that day. And it also says that they did not take any of their plunder. I guess we could say a teaching moment here. There's a better way to say it, but the world says it this way. What goes around comes around. You know, Haman had plotted to kill all the Jews, but the script was flipped, and it went the other way. So reading from Esther 9, verse 23, thus the Jews undertook what they had started to do and what Mordecai had written to them. For Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the adversary of the Jews, had schemed against the Jews to destroy them and had cast pur, that is the lot, to disturb and to destroy them. But when it came to the king's attention, he commanded by letter that his wicked scheme, which he had devised against the Jews, should return on his own head, and that he and his son should be hanged on the gallows. Therefore they call these days Purim, after the name of Pur. And because of the instructions in this letter, both what they had seen in this regard and what had happened to them, the Jews established and made a custom for themselves and for their descendants and for all those who allied themselves with them, so that they would not fail to celebrate these 2 days according to their regulation and according to their appointed time annually. So these days really were to be remembered and celebrated throughout every generation, every family, every province, every city, and these days of Purim were not to fail from among the Jews, or their memory fade from their descendants. All right, so I've been talking for 34 minutes right now, and I want to pause and say, according to some of the podcasts that I suffer through, I got a pretty good message going here. Like some of the preachers say, I'm preaching better than you're letting on right now. You know, we've covered several teaching points. After the six-month-long party, revelry leads to problems in your marriage. After they decided, let's go get a harem, one bad decision leads to another. Esther replaced Queen Vashti. We talked about how the good rises to the top. Just keep doing good. Mordecai foiled the assassination plan. We talked about diligence. Do what's right, even though you're in a bad situation. Mordecai wouldn't bow. That was a great example of how your pride and arrogance can lead to destruction. And Haman exalts himself over Mordecai, but pride goes before a fall. In fact, the seventh teaching point this morning, when the Jews killed all their enemies, instead of being killed by their enemies, you know, what goes around comes around. Those are seven good points. There are seven things that we really need to learn. It's beneficial. But I've set you up. And I really hope that you're a little put out at this point. Not just because we're 7 minutes past noon and we got to get to lunch. But I hope you're really put out. Because from the time I started talking until now, I haven't said God's name one time. I haven't said the name of Jesus. I haven't said faith. I haven't said prayer. I haven't said trust. I didn't even pray at the beginning of the message. I did that intentionally because that's exactly what the writer of Esther did. Not once in the book of Esther will you find. The name of God. You won't find prayer. You might say, wait a minute, didn't they fast and pray? No, they just said fast. Well, didn't that help? Yeah, maybe it did. Prayer isn't mentioned. Trust isn't mentioned. The temple isn't mentioned. There's no sacrifice that's mentioned. None of it's mentioned anywhere. No miracles are recorded. Nobody did a miracle in this book. In fact, right now today, when they celebrate the Feast of Purim, which is like early March sometime, time frame there, even during today's celebration of Purim, there is no mention of God. There are no praise songs, no halal. And that's because they say that the book of Esther was a physical deliverance. It had nothing to do with spiritual, and so it's just a physical celebration. So why did I waste all your time with a godless story? I didn't waste your time. Hang in there. Why did I take all this time with a story that God's not in? Well, let's remember, first of all, that this story is about God's people. But it's about God's people that didn't go back to Jerusalem. The story actually takes place between the two invitations given to go back to the land. So before this story took place, the invitation was to go back and rebuild the temple, and later was the wall. In between those two invitations is where this story is. So the first time that Jews were given an opportunity to go back to Jerusalem, 50,000 people went. Now that sounds like a lot. If we had 50,000 people here in Bridgeville, that'd be a lot. That'd be a mess. But considering the fact that there were millions of Jews and only 50,000 felt compelled, probably in their walk with the Lord, to go back to Jerusalem, that's a pretty small number. And what that tells you is that the people that stayed in Babylon, which became Persia and Iran, they weren't inclined to go back to Jerusalem. There wasn't this thing in them that said, I got to go back. And rebuild the temple, and rebuild the wall, and rebuild the whole nation. They got comfortable in their bondage. They stayed where they were. And so this story is about God's people that aren't necessarily following him, the carnal Christian. Now, it's also, maybe I'm the only one who does this. I'm not. But maybe I'm the only one who, I have moments of carnality. I have situations where I kind of like Babylon. Not really ready to abandon Babylon and trek 900 miles over to Jerusalem. Not really ready to experience the cross. So there's areas in my life where I'm in this same spot. And yet we see in this story that God will never forsake his people. Even when they choose the world. Even when they choose to live in sin. Good reason or bad reason. Mordecai says, I am not going to bow to that man. He was just being proud and arrogant. It wasn't because of righteousness or holiness. It wasn't because he's expecting me to worship him and I only worship God. No, it was just out of, I ain't bowing to that man. So even when they sin, even when they choose the world, even when they choose to stay where they are, God will not forsake his people. And the thing that thrilled me in this story, there's no miracle listed. But you can't help but see all the miracles everywhere in this story. God is so moving behind the scenes. People like you and me, I can't miss it. You think that King Ahasuerus just happened to pick Esther out of 127 provinces? Maybe she was that pretty. But you think Mordecai just happened to foil an assassination attempt? He just happened to hear the names and the people and got right word to the right people? You think that Queen Esther just happened to find favor, walked in on the king, and he decided, I'll let her live. What do you got? And it was just dumb luck. You think the king just happened to have insomnia that night? You think his bedtime story readers just happened to roll the scroll to that part of the story? What a coincidence. You think Haman just happened to have a plan on how to exalt himself? You think he just happened to have gallows built? You think King Ahasuerus just happened to walk in from the garden at just the right time that Haman is falling to beg for his life? Oh no, he's assaulting my queen. You're a dead man. Just happened. See, the funny thing is, it's the Feast of Purim. And the Purim, the Pur, P-U-R, stands for the word Lot. And as we read earlier in the book, Haman the whole time is casting lots. He's casting lots and he's casting lots, trusting to fate. When is a good time to annihilate the Jews? And I think Mordecai actually summed it up pretty well in his statement that he made earlier when he said, and who knows whether you've become attained royalty for such a time as this. He's saying, and who knows? I know why she attained royalty. And I know who did it. It was none other than God working behind the scenes. God in his great grace, in his great faithfulness, in his promise-keeping character, he has illustrated for us all in this story of Esther that he masterfully and sovereignly, without violating free will, orchestrates the life and times of everything that exists to protect his people from being wiped out by their own sin. As we wrap this up, Daniel 4:35 says, all the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, but he does according to his will in the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. And no one can ward off his hand or say to him, what have you done? So in the story, he used his people who preferred to stay in Babylon. And in your life and mine, there are areas where we prefer to stay in Babylon. He did it for those who stay in Babylon. He did it for carnal Christians. How much more for those who love him? those of us who are walking with him. The encouragement is God is all the time working behind the scenes, and things just magically happen. They don't magically happen. God does it. One of the best examples was in the Holloway family when they got a phone call. Just it seemed to be out of the blue, and Patrick can come visit. How much time had been spent in praying about that being able to happen and all the ins and outs of that. And then one day, a phone call out of the blue. What luck. No, God's working behind the scenes. 2 Chronicles 16:9, for the eyes of the Lord move to and fro throughout the earth that he may strongly support those whose heart is completely his. Let's pray. Our Heavenly Father, we're thankful to you for your goodness to us. I thank you for overriding the foolishness of the speaker, overriding our flesh. I thank you for feeding us. I thank you most of all for accomplishing always, sovereignly, masterfully, your perfect plan, moving through the course of events, the little and the great. May you be glorified. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.